You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Obsessive-compulsive disorder has become a conversational phrase that's used pretty casually. We talk about someone's OCD to mean that they're picky or orderly or acting like a neatnik. And we wondered about that line between acting like you have OCD and truly living with it, which about 1 in 100 adults in America do. Plus, there's some new research offering ways to treat it. So Robin Kirk, who specializes in treatment for obsessive-compulsive disorder and other anxieties, is the owner of Sage Psychotherapy Associates. She's been a therapist herself for nearly 20 years and is joining us this morning. Hello.
Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So what's the clinical definition of OCD?
The clinical definition is experiencing obsessions, which are kind of like what-if thoughts. What if I didn't turn off the stove and the house burns down? And then the compulsions are basically anything that you do to make yourself feel better. So that can be reassuring thoughts. It can be checking the stove, or it can be avoiding a behavior like not shaking someone's hands if you're worried about contamination. And to really have a diagnosis of OCD, it needs to impact your life and get in the way of it.
Is it true that it's not fully a mental disorder?
It is a brain chemistry disorder.
It is a brain chemistry disorder. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then there's this conversational way that we refer to it casually. Oh, it's my OCD acting up. And in talking that way, it's kind of thrown out a big net on all of our behaviors. Talk to me about the line between the real and the casual behavior.
When someone with OCD experiences something, when they're triggered with that fear, it's like if you're a parent and you're in the shopping mall with your child, like a three-year-old holding their hand, and you turn around and your child's not there, that sort of rush of anxiety, that panic, is what someone with OCD would feel if they touch a door handle and there's gook on it, and if they have contamination fears. So it's that level of anxiety, not just, oh, I like everything to be just right. I'm so OCD about that is something you hear a lot.
And maybe that's a better way to distinguish it, to talk about what it's not.
Mm-hmm.
What is not OCD?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me some examples of things that don't qualify, behaviors that don't qualify?
Well, it really is a function of the degree or the severity.
Okay.
So let's say I don't like spiders. So I might ask you to kill a spider that's in the room, but I would then be able to go about my day. If I had OCD and one of the aspects of it was spiders involved, I would have to run from the room. I might not be able to come back in this room because what if that spider had a little spider family in the corner? Might not be able to come back to this building because what if this is just a nest of spiders and they're not all gone? So it's really about how debilitating it is and how much it impacts your functioning on a regular basis.
That's such a clear-cut, small question to ask to help define it, how obsessive is the what-if question.
Mm-hmm.
So I said 1 in 100 adults, and in terms of young adults, children, it's 1 in 200.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that an area where this kicks in is in college-age students. What's going on in that age group?
Well, one of the reasons we'll see people at that age group coming into treatment is a lot of times when they're younger, the family can accommodate. So if I had, let's say I was in high school and I had some contamination issues and I had a really long kind of getting ready process in the morning, I had to shower for a long time and I had a real ritual that I had to follow, my family might accommodate that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I took 2 hours, they might grumble about it, but they might take their showers around that period of time. I go away to college and all of a sudden I'm in a suite bathroom. My suite mates are not going to love that. So I might not be able to do my ritual. Plus, there might be social alienation about it. People might start talking about me. They might start laughing. I might feel socially isolated. And then if I couldn't do my rituals, if I couldn't do the compulsions, then all day I might be distracted by, did I get clean enough? What if? What if I still have dirt somewhere? What if? And then my studies might really suffer because I wouldn't be able to focus. So we'll see kids who, and it's heartbreaking because especially as hard as it is to get into colleges and people dream about it their whole lives now, and you go away to college and it really becomes debilitating. And so people will have to come home.
Is the incidence on the rise?
Not necessarily. It's fairly consistent.
And the rituals that you describe, what role do the rituals play in the disorder?
The rituals serve the function of reducing anxiety. So if, let's use the spider for an example, if I saw a spider in the corner, I would ask you to kill it and I would leave the room. So I'm avoiding it. It's just to reduce the anxiety. And one of the tough things is that it does reduce anxiety briefly. So there is that, even if it's only for 30 seconds, I get some relief. So in some of the thoughts are like thought compulsions. If I have the thought, if I have a negative thought about the color red, for example, then something bad is going to happen to somebody I love. That's it. To get a little bit of relief from that really reinforces that. So what we're finding is that what we really want to do is to help people get better at having anxiety so it's not so frightening and they don't have to do all these things to make it go away. It can just be there and not be such a big deal.
Versus making the anxiety go away, you just assume that it is a present component of everyday life. So what is the combination of treatment?
Well, traditionally, with exposure and response prevention, which the name is pretty descriptive, you're exposed to something that causes anxiety, and then you're prevented from doing your typical compulsion. So with that, the traditional thought was you had to repeat that, do a hierarchy of fears from low to high.
Right.
You'd have to repeat it over and over again until you didn't have anxiety when you approached whatever your fear stimulus was, and that you had to do that. It's tough. About 20% of the people who want to find out about treatment say, no, thank you. That sounds awful. And about 30% of the people who begin treatment drop out really early on because it's tough. You're sitting there with something for 45 minutes or an hour not knowing what to do with your anxiety. But what research has shown is that we don't have to do that. You do need to be exposed to the things that scare you. But you don't have to repeat it and just sit with it over and over again. And it doesn't, the factors that we used to think were so important, like how much anxiety you triggered or going about it in a really logical hierarchy and approaching it that way, those factors don't improve outcome. They don't really affect outcome. So instead of approaching it to make the anxiety go away, it's learning a process of how to experience the anxiety so it's not as fearful and you don't have to do things to make it go away.
And the name of that approach, if I understand this right, is mindfulness-based treatment, which is what the research is heralding. It's also what you practice. Can you give me an example? Obviously not identifying anybody, but an example of how this is working or has worked?
Sure. We use the mindfulness-based treatment that we combine with exposure is acceptance and commitment therapy in particular. So that gives people, we use both mindfulness meditation and ways to kind of get some space from your thoughts. So let's say you're going to give a speech. And you're nervous, a little bit nervous about doing, a little bit anxious.
That's usually true.
Is it for you even?
I just kind of accept I'm never going to get over it. It's been that way since I've been little and all these years. It never goes away.
Exactly. You completely capsulized it that you know it's going to be there. You can feel maybe your heart beats a little bit faster.
Yep.
Maybe get a little bit of heat. And you can still go up and talk to people and try to get as much information out as you can. So you said it beautifully.
Well, I used to think I just hadn't found the right code to make it go away. And now I'm too old to think that it's going to go away. So it's just always there. But the true symptom, I want to return to this, of OCD is going to be more than just what we're describing, my little nervousness or my heart racing a little bit. Let's go back to those true symptoms.
The true symptoms would then, there's something called thought-action fusion that really plays an important role in OCD. And in that, it means if you have a thought, you believe that it then increases the likelihood of that happening. Or sometimes having the thought that makes it you're a bad person because you've had that thought. Just having the thought has a lot of meaning. So if you have a thought, then you have to do a lot of work to make that go away.
So the thought actually shuts you down or inhibits you or paralyzes you in some way.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
I'm talking with Robin Kirk, who is a member of the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, the International OCD Foundation, Anxiety Disorders Association of America, and the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science. And the reason I list all that is because OCD isn't the only anxiety disorder you treat, and there's a whole packet here that come under that umbrella.
There are. And a lot of the mechanisms for the anxiety disorders are the same and can be treated in really similar ways. So we also treat social anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, hair pulling, skin picking, social anxiety, I think I said that already, and then specific phobias as well.
I read a sentence that I'd like you to decode for me, and it is that counterintuitively, ending the struggle against anxiety actually allows it to pass more quickly. And that's kind of what we've been talking about, but why is that word counterintuitively part of that sentence?
Humans are great problem solvers. And if I feel anxiety, that could be a signal to me that this is a problem to be solved. And so we'll go about trying to get rid of it. So the kind of the common sense way is just make the problem go away, solve this somehow. If it's too hot in here, we can turn the thermostat down and make it cooler. And sometimes we approach our internal experiences in that same way. So not doing it, stepping back, and as you said with public speaking, just knowing the anxiety might arise in you and it's okay and you can feel that and then go ahead and do what's important to you anyway.
It's a lifelong journey really to master ourselves, isn't it?
It is.
We have no business trying to manage anybody else. We just have to deal with our own situation. So does this conversational shorthand in the long run help? The fact that we joke about OCD or we use the phrase casually?
I don't know that it helps because I don't know that it necessarily raises awareness about what it really is. Mm. And for like the people that we treat who come in and we'll hear people say, oh, I'm just the OCD about that.
Yeah.
It feels really kind of diminishing to them and what their experience is because they know just that degree of intensity that they experience is just really different from what people are talking about.
Well, you've enlightened me. I think I'm going to toss out OCD and just use the word anxious because that sounds more appropriate for most of what we experience.
That's great.
All right. Thank you, Robin. Robin Kirk is the owner of Sage Psychotherapy in Sacramento. We have more information about OCD online at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we're going to talk with the stars and the director of a production of The Turn of the Screw.